drawing near. Brothers, sisters, please get ready. Brothers, sisters, please get ready. Brothers, sisters, please get ready. For the time is drawing near. Oh, they'll be.
Hello, you are tuned into KKRN Community Radio 88.5 in Round Mountain, California. My name is Sharon Brizalera, and I am host of Bending the Arc, a locally produced show that you support. And I'm here today in conversation with Alan Ernesto Phillips. I know Alan through a number of different intersections, and he's going to share a little bit about his background, but today in particular, he's going to be talking about his experience as a member of the Hate Crimes Task Force, which is under the DOJ. And I'll kick it over to you, Alan, to tell us a little bit more about that, but first about your background, the many things that you have done in our community.
Well, thank you, Sharon, and thanks to your listeners and supporters. This is a terrific outreach, and I'm honored to be here. Well, I've been involved in many creative professions and other community-enriching projects for a long time. Currently play in a cool band called Mumblefinger, which is a pretty cool jazz rock, bluesy sort of swamp rock band. And we play a lot in between Chico and Ashland, mostly in the festival and concert circuits. As a journalist, I've been involved with reporting and electronic news gathering since probably 1978 in Portland, Oregon, where I began my career. I've contributed to local news sources, Native American Times, CNN, and my favorite local news source, which is A News Cafe. As a film and video producer director since 1976, I've worked with some of the very best professionals and celebrities in the business, receiving many awards and doing a lot of national work. Locally, I got involved with the Shasta County Chemical People, where we had a wonderful partnership. And I was a project manager for a SAMHSA-granted program that taught parenting classes and trained other people to teach them, which was also adopted by the local courts for people who were mandated for parenting help, and also people who just wanted to learn to help be assertive in their parenting and co-guiding their children into the difficult passage sometimes into adulthood. And that was about a 14-year career that I did with them and totally loved it. And I should mention that it was the most successful grantee in the nation for best practice programs. And that was also in part because of the fantastic scientific evaluation component, which you you ran. And I always speak praises about you because you are a real deal and am honored to have learned from you. Let's see, 1999, I got involved with the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition.
Yes.
And was a co-founder and became chairman and went through the various board positions for a long time. A wonderful organization I'll probably talk a little bit more about as we go along. In 2014, the governor of our state appointed me as a director of the 27th Agricultural District Association, which runs the Shasta District Fair. And as I apologized earlier about smelling like cattle and kids and dust, I've been at the fair today and we'll be returning after we chat. I really do love working with children and students and building them up, developing their assets to do great things in ag professions, which I'm a big supporter of. Since 2004, I've worked with the Hate Crimes Task Force, as you mentioned, which is under the DOJ, which has the U.S. Attorney's Office, Eastern District. And I serve as a member on the task force as a North State liaison for reporting hate crimes. And so my job is to forum with terrific law enforcement professionals and experts in the fields of research behind law enforcement, as well as those who prosecute hate crimes and other crimes. I get to fellow with a lot of other community leaders from Bakersfield to the Oregon border to the Nevada border to Trinity County. And if there is a substantiated hate crime, a hate crime that has merit and has evidences that support that, and of course substantiate it, I'm able to report those crimes directly to the U.S. attorney, and I have his ear, and that is Philip Talbert, who is a fantastic steward of our country and our community up here in Shasta County.
Great. Well, I want to dive in. You said a lot there about about many things. But first, about the task force, how was it that you first, it was brought to your attention? How did you first become involved?
That's a good question. It was several incidents that took place in our area that sort of piqued me to want to be involved and to be more activist in my involvement. Rather than just being aware of something, I really wanted to put that awareness into direct physical action in my community. After the racially motivated hate crime of a cross burning that was placed on the front lawn of a biracial family in Anderson, McGregor Scott was our district attorney around that time, and he had just taken the helm of the U.S. Attorney's Office around 2003. I think that incident took place in 2004, and I just had to get involved. I'd had a really good relationship with McGregor Scott, who was a partner for the Shasta County Chemical people in being a stakeholder of what we were doing in the community to help parents. And so I had his ear already, and we had a wonderful friendship aside. It's, I think, kind of important to sort of explain the Hate Crimes Task Force. It's called the Greater Sacramento Hate Crimes Task Force, and it's brought a diverse community of leaders together with federal, state, and local law enforcement officials to form a united front in the district's effort to combat hate crimes. The task force now meets biannually. We used to go about every quarter, but it's sort of reduced in our participation. But it's ongoing, it's active, and continues serving us up here, even though we have this isolation and insulation from some of the main centers in our state. Shasta County and some of our neighboring counties are geographically isolated from sort of mainstream, but they remain active, and we have a terrific relationship with them, and we always have an ear with them. It's important to know that the U.S. attorney or our chief federal prosecutor, who is now Philip Talbert, hosts a select panel of law enforcement experts during most hate crime task force meetings. So we're actively engaged in learning current trends, current research, and what is being done on their end. For example, a lot of people don't know that there's an issue called implicit racism. Judges, prosecutors, police officers, other professionals in the law enforcement communities that surround us have substantiated issues of not only civil rights violations, but also overreach under the color of law when it comes to working with people of color or people of difference.
So let me just ask you there. Sure. So it sounds like there's ongoing training and awareness, and part of it is the existence of implicit racism and that it affects everyone. And here is the potential impact within the purview of the Hate Crimes Task Force.
They could certainly avoid providing research information and actual training to judges, to lawyers, and so forth. But they do the difficult work behind the scenes to try and help develop tolerance within the complicated calculus of law enforcement and adjudication.
Yes, yes.
The United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of California represents the federal government in virtually all litigation involving the United States in the Eastern District of California. This includes all criminal prosecutions for violation of federal law, civil lawsuits by and against the government, and actions to collect judgments and restitution on behalf of victims and taxpayers. So they're also involved in supporting the victimization component that can happen. And sometimes there are grants that are available to help people, if not become whole again, to help them, you know, recover from trauma and other disenfranchisement. The Eastern District of California is one of the largest judicial districts in the country, both in terms of population and landmass. Our district has almost 8 million residents and encompasses six large urban areas: Sacramento, Fresno, Bakersfield, Stockton, Vallejo, and Fairfield. It extends more than 87,000 square miles, 45% of which is federal land. It includes 34 counties reaching from the Oregon border in the north down to Bakersfield in the south, and from the coastal mountains in the west to the Nevada border to the east. And this is the area where I serve as a North State liaison in, you know, keeping current with other community leaders and for reporting substantiated hate crimes directly to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm. How do the members of the task force have the opportunity to bring particular issues or cases forward? I would imagine there's multiple ways that information gets to the task force. How does that happen?
Well, that's another great question. I can give you some actual examples.
Sure.
Some people in our community remember that the Palisadro brothers, Benjamin and James Williams, pleaded guilty to torching three Jewish synagogues and were facing trial for the murders of a beloved Happy Family gay couple, Gary Mattson and Winfield Mauder. And that was in 1999.
Right.
According to the investigators, the brothers were involved with a white extremist Christian identity group whose white supremacist anti-Semitic views troubled law enforcement agencies around the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Another famous follower and cohort with these guys was the infamous follower of the same cult, Eric Rudolph, who bombed abortion clinics and was responsible for the Olympic bombing. After his brother's suicide to avoid trial, James Williams pled guilty to the hate crimes and was sentenced to 28 years to life in prison. So the Hate Crimes Task Force, you know, was born from tragedies like the Mattson Mauder horrors, cross burning on the lawn, and this helped develop and fuel the Hate Crimes Task Force. But sadly, it also put us on their radar up here in Northern California of having high need for some of these right-wing extremists who have acted out in violent, hateful ways.
And it sounds like, too, that law enforcement may be submitting those directly, that the task force, those involved in the task force, might become aware of issues, that there's multiple ways that it rises to that level of consideration. Someone has to identify it as a hate crime.
Correct. Yes, exactly. I mean, there's a specific criteria what a hate crime is. You know, the definition from the Department of Justice is pretty clear, and I happen to have brought that with me
because
I knew
so
you were going to probably ask. But what's the difference between a hate crime and a hate incident?
Yes, yes.
So, you know, a hate crime is a crime against a person, group, or property motivated by the victim's real or perceived protected social group. You could be the victim of a hate crime if you have been targeted because of your actual or perceived, one, disability, two, gender, three, nationality, four, race or ethnicity, five, religion, six, sexual orientation, and seven, association with a person or group with one or more of these actual perceived characteristics. Hate crimes are serious crimes that may result in imprisonment or jail time. A hate incident, on the other hand, is an action or behavior motivated by hate, but which, for one or more reasons, is not considered a crime. Mm-hmm. Examples of hate incidents include name-calling, insults, displaying hate material on your own property, posting hate material that does not result in property damage, distribution of materials with hate messages in public places. So what defines a hate crime? Let's say we were to have an incident here, and hopefully people report an alleged hate crime if they suspect it is or not sure. They should report it to start a paper trail, as we like to say. Law enforcement officers, sheriff or municipal police who respond hopefully will be trained in diversity awareness, and respond professionally and with sensitivity. Take the information and collect the evidence and do a forthright reporting on their own jurisdiction of a hate crime or a hate incident. That then gives more power for prosecution of a hate crime, or keeping a formal memorialization of a hate incident, because that is kept as documented evidence or something that could support evidence down the road showing intent. So, hopefully our law enforcement officers are not what are called ghost skins. I don't know if you're familiar with the term ghost skin.
I'm not.
Ghost skin is a formal FBI researched and codified description of skinhead-like or white supremacist-like mindsets and activities under a badge, under a black robe on the bench, under a congressperson's pin or a senator's pin. They are considered ghost skins because they are acting sometimes in overreach of the law, but can be under the radar.
Is that something that the task force talks about?
We do. In my own experience, I've been falsely arrested by a Reading police officer. Arrested me for interfering with a group of officers, interfering with them in a line of duty, which I did not do and was able to prove with a good lawyer. Mm-hmm. When I was arrested, I was called Pancho because I was speaking to my brother in Spanish. And they didn't like that and were very aggressive in throwing me in the car, booked me in the jail. I had an arrest record. But fortunately, I was able to have a judge pinch his nose in the courtroom with the district attorney's charges against me and throw it in a wastebasket. I'm not going to name the judge because they're not supposed to do things like that on the bench, but he was very accurate in his disgust. And I was able to get the officer fired. He had three priors for related questionable hate handling of other suspects. Mm-hmm. I was able to get him fired. So I know that ghost skins exist personally, and through substantiated cases that I've been able to review within my outreach, they exist, and many of them go undiscovered, unprosecuted, and continue to hide and have gotten better at hiding, but they exist. Not all cops are bad. I know some wonderful ones.
Right, right. Well, and I know on the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition, you had a really strong relationship and still do.
Well, we did until Chief Paletti took over, and it stopped. It instantly evaporated.
The Hispanic Latino Coalition or the connection?
The relationship. We had built a relationship since 1999. We started with Chief Blankenship, went to Chief Modi, Leonard mm-hmm. Modi, mm-hmm. Went to Peter Hansen, and we had great relationships. When Chief Paletti came in, it stopped. It was like at the drop of a hat. We were no longer brought in to help with sensitivity training, diversity training with officers, most of which rolled their eyes when we were trying to, give them insight into our various communities. But some of them appreciated it. And we had an ongoing long-term relationship with a fantastic law enforcement professional, Samuel Llamas,
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who to this day is a highly respected law enforcement officer within mm-hmm. not just the Hispanic Latino community, but all communities.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to ask you about something. You know, you had mentioned substantiated cases and if cases are reported. And Tom O'Mara was on the show, and he was speaking about, in his role as liaison, the importance of reporting and his feelings about how difficult it can be to get those reports, to have people understand the process, to actually do it. And so I wanted to hear about your perspective on that and your experience in people coming forward about hate crimes.
Yeah, perhaps some of the greatest barriers to implementing an active investigation of an alleged hate crime is getting accurate reporting of hate crimes mm-hmm. to the DOJ by encouraging victims to report their potential victimization, including evidences to support their claims, bringing proper documentation, all of which lead to substantiation of a claim. And the barriers are also compounded when somebody has been victimized. Typically, they're going to be in a mental breakdown. They're going to be in trauma. They're going to their animal brain, and they're not really fully functioning in logic and reasoning, and don't in an instant go, oh, I better collect evidence. I better, go to the hospital and get a doctor to examine my injury so I have a paper trail to substantiate what I'm saying.
Right.
I mean, people don't think about, oh, there's a witness here who saw it. I better get his contact information so I can, have somebody who can verify what I'm saying. So, it's very difficult to get accurate reporting. Law enforcement really has probably more of a frequency of reporting potential hate crimes for prosecution, going to the next level. They're on the front lines, and they're breaking up the fight, or they're, getting their fire extinguishers to extinguish a burning cross on somebody's lawn. They're there, and they can identify the factors that indicate an actual hate crime has taken place. So, hopefully they are, full functioning themselves and are accurate in collecting evidences.
It sounds in part, you're saying that there's a role for law enforcement and other attending to those events in helping people understand what they could do and facilitating the
exactly.
reporting.
They should also be involved in recognizing somebody is in trauma or in actual shock from physical wounds or just intense harassment. And they should be able to, law enforcement have so much to do, and we're tagging so many other duties on them to be counselors and so forth. But, hopefully there is a response team that is a part of law enforcement that can aid in kind of the psychological triage and treatment of somebody who's been traumatized, and encourage them. What do you remember? Do you have a description? Do you, to get all this information and make notes mm-hmm. of what they're hearing. Mm-hmm. If somebody's out there and is just tending to somebody conversationally and does not make notes for reporting, that unfortunate situation can lead to no evidence to support a hate crime.
Right, and it has been really encouraging to see the crisis intervention response team come on board, and we're hoping to talk to some folks there on the show as well.
Oh, good, I agree.
But I wanted to follow up and to see if, so say for whatever reason notes haven't been taken or law enforcement wasn't called in, is the task force or others in the community doing anything to help support people in that process? We know that some people are afraid. Certainly knowing what to do with whom can be an issue. Is there anyone that's helping to facilitate that process that you know of?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I know of a few law enforcement professionals who are trained in diversity awareness of all differences in our wonderful, brilliant spectrum of humanity, and I've witnessed it myself, showing up to an incident or something and seeing these officers really help co-guide a potential victim of a hate crime or just, you know, a crime unrelated to hate. I don't see a lot. I don't know of many who do that. I think most law enforcement officers, sheriffs, marshals, municipal, they're taxed. They're challenged with so many duties, and I really can't, in my heart of hearts, expect them to be able to do all jobs,
especially
when they're involved in a situation.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I was thinking about, because, you know, as you know, the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition is brings together a range of organizations with different perspectives and different foci, but the members and allies are often reflecting on what can we do as a coalition, or is there a role that one of the member organizations could play in helping that, being that bridge? And so I just wonder your perspective as a member of the task force, what would it be great if individuals or organizations did to help with that work?
This is a great thing, and I think the coalition is on the right track. I truly believe that awareness, based on current research, is really fundamental to providing change. Law enforcement officials can't always do everything. Their actions are sometimes different from what we're hoping to do with the coalition. Mm-hmm. The great news is that we're reaching out to law enforcement and with the response team that we have now to help diffuse what could be a mental health issue or a dual diagnosis drug situation, and there's violence involved or potential suicide. I mean, so many things happen at once, but we didn't always have that response team. Mm-hmm. And it came about because of trauma, loss, and just awful, awful after effects from that touches the whole community. So since we know much more about that, of course, it's kind of based on trauma that tends to get law enforcement involved. It would be nice if law enforcement became, better funded to embolden and, I think, diversify the response team to help bridge some language barriers in a situation. Hopefully they are diverse trained and can respond accordingly.
Latino Coalition, but if you're just dropping into this conversation, this is Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio 88.5 out of Round Mountain and Bella Vista. And I'm in conversation with Alan Ernesto Phillips. In his many roles, we've been talking about the Hate Crimes Task Force. And now we're diving in a little bit more to the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition, which is an example of one of those organizations like we try to bring together to have an amplified voice in the SEJC. And I know that, you know, currently the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition had a committed, dedicated set of folks who worked tirelessly as their second or third job getting things off the ground. And it's been in a bit of a rest period as those members have gotten other work and whatnot. What do you see, well, and anything that you know about where we are in the process with the coalition, but also what do you see being the need for an organization like that today?
Great question. Well, the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition was founded in 1999 by a bunch of local activists.
That's the technical term, right? A bunch of activists.
Yeah. Gaggle. Who wanted to take an awareness of problems and do something, to be active in fostering change and, you know, improving the lives of everyone in our community, not just Hispanics, Latinos, and indigenous Latinos, of which I am. I descend from the Popil tribe of El Salvador. Where my mother was born. I'm a first-generation American. Getting involved with the coalition brought together Latinos in the area who were professionals in other walks of life, and everybody saw the need to try and do something. And it began in 1999. I helped co-found it with a bunch of wonderful local people, Amelia de la Torre Ward, Cristina Madrigal, Silvia Aguirre, and so many others that I'm unfortunately not able to name right now for time. But, you know, we wanted to do something. And my plank in particular was to rebuild the bridge between law enforcement and the Hispanic, Latino, indigenous communities. And we were able to convince Bob Blankenship at the time, who was the Reading police chief, to get on board and start dialoguing with us. It just began having conversations. His door was open to us, and it was. We were kind of surprised. We expect to hear, oh, my door is always open for you guys anytime you want, and then you never get to see them again. But he did. He opened his doors to us and listened to us at first. What I wanted to do was to help with the need to keep our community safe from pandilleros or gangsters, the Hispanic Latino gangs that were in our area. And they were recruiting our local youth to be lookouts and mules. And it sounded very attractive to our youth, you know, to be a part of a gang that's there for them. And they gave them this sense of false belonging that I've called for many years. And so it was difficult to try and engage Latino youth in being active in the community, being productive, staying in school, being better than they were. So Chief Blankenship finally mentioned to us, well, you know what? We got a real serious problem here with gangs. I'm glad you brought it up. We have cartels using Interstate 5 and 299 as a crossroads of Northern California for drug distribution. And
this is back in 1999.
This is 1999, exactly. And 98-99 when we first started talking to him. And then Chief Modi came on board, Leonard Modi, and his door opened even wider. And he actually gave us direct connections with captains of various divisions within law enforcement. If there were an incident related to a Mexican national, for example, had an illegal drug operation, and an officer involved shooting was involved to take down the threat, I would get a call 11 o'clock at night saying, Alan, this is Captain so-and-so. I need to let you know this happened today, and I wanted to alert you. And if you in your community have any information that can help us identify this person, we would really appreciate it. So we became proactive with law enforcement in mutual reporting, in mutual dialogue. And Chief Leonard Modi was awesome in helping us with that. And he empowered us and he built us up and fueled us to do more active involvement in supporting law enforcement, the schools in our community. Chief Peter Hansen, another wonderful stalwart that helped us as well. Love that guy. And a lot of the law enforcement officers at the time, Dwayne Morrison, who was a bilingual mm-hmm. officer, did great work. That's how we met Samuel Llamas. So the Hispanic Latino Coalition evolved to be proactive in making Shasta County a better community for everybody, not just Latinos, indigenous people, but everybody. And we missed that relationship. Currently, the Hispanic Latino Coalition is sort of eroded somewhat. We had a 501c3 mm-hmm. charter as a nonprofit organization, corporation. And a lot of us worked very hard to keep that going. After 10, 12 years, we decided to turn it over to younger people. Old guys like me decided, yeah, let's get these young people involved. Let's get some new ideas. They might think of things we can't because we're so closed off and old. And so we got a lot of young people involved. However, we didn't really think about the barriers to young people in being involved. Mm-hmm. In managing something like a nonprofit organization that involves Hispanic, Latino, Indigenous people. And so, minimum wage is a barrier.
Yes.
Going to school, matriculating into higher education, some of them raising families, took its toll. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the funding to be able to sustain the Hispanic Latino Coalition that would also empower these wonderful, young, brilliant people to bring new life and to build this group. And it was just one of those obstacles we didn't really think about at the time. But I'm sorry, but funding is an unfortunate barrier to us having a safe, wonderful society.
It is difficult, and I know United Way of Northern California, one of the things that they've looked at in their equity grant, which is not to fully support any one nonprofit, but really looks at that issue of operational funds and not tied to a ton of requirements and making the application easier.
Yes.
For folks.
Exactly. And even, fundraising efforts have, their own filters. It's something I would, go so far as to say that, people like the McConnell Foundation, the grant resource opportunities we have. I think a lot of the leaders within those organizations really need to examine the Justice Equity Coalition and what they're doing to keep that going, because I know it's essentially new mm-hmm. and it's growing and it's bettering itself. It's working on weightier matters that unfortunately can end or be diminished by lack of funding. So, hopefully, you rich people out there too, put the coalition in your will. Bequeath. Keep this sustained, other people who are stewards of granting organizations really need to step up and examine this mm-hmm. closely and support it.
Mm-hmm. They can support the station too.
Exactly. Yeah, and I have to really say my thanks to the listeners, the people who donate $5, $25 a month, whatever you can. I sound like I'm doing a pledge drive, but I just have to tell you that every dollar that is given is for weightier matters. And I just have to say, I appreciate everybody who does support this station and supports the Justice Equity mm-hmm. Coalition.
Yeah, thank you. Were you born here?
Yes. My mother was born in El Salvador, and they fled La Matanza, which was a massacre that took place in the 30s, where U.S.-backed corporations, mining interests, extractive corporations went in and paid the El Salvador government to murder about 35,000 indigenous people who were my cousins. And so my grandmother gathered up all her kids and they fled El Salvador and moved here. So I was born in Shasta County as a first generation American here. We were from the Pipil tribe from El Salvador. And so I've been here a long time, born and raised. I've met the haters my whole life in school. You know, I was called a taco bender and a beaner and all those horrible things that people laugh at that aren't funny. Teachers treated me differently. They tried to, in a negative tending, correct my accent. They didn't like it when I spoke Spanish. They didn't like it when I sang Spanish songs. And so it was difficult growing up in Shasta County, which was far more racist than it is now. I see it bettering, you know, but the last few years I've seen it worsening. I think, and this is just me saying this, but I think the previous administrator of our country gave license to people who hid in their racism. It gave them license to be active themselves. So I've grown up in a county that was very hateful. But one thing I will say, not all white people hate. I went to Meadow Lane School in Anderson, where I, when I was born, I lived in Anderson for about 10 years. And I had a teacher, her name was Jean Reinhardt. Maybe some of you listeners remember Jean Reinhardt at Meadow Lane School. She was my second grade teacher. And she saw me being taunted and teased, and she saw other teachers being mean to me for my brownness and my hispanidad, my Hispanicness. Mm-hmm. And I remember a few times, but one time in particular, she took me behind the school building. And I thought, oh no, she's going to unleash on me. My mind closed down as best she can as a second grader. And so I just kind of buckled for what was going to come next. And she said to me, she goes, Alan, she said, I'm curious, how do you say apple in Spanish? And so I was kind of shocked again, because here's a teacher asking me to teach her. And I said, manzana. And manzana means apple in Spanish. She goes, oh, thank you very much. And she started writing it down on her hand. And she goes, well, how do you say this? How do you say that? She's asking me this. And I just felt so empowered. It's like, wow, a white teacher is asking me for advice, is building my assets. So it's the first asset builder in developing me as a human being who was white. And it happened again another day. It happened again a month later and so forth. And so a couple of times she was able to sort of intervene for me, sort of protecting me as best she could. But the thing I remember most was while she took me behind the school building, she would always look over her shoulder because she was worried about getting caught. She was afraid probably to lose her job or to become admonished for empowering in dealing with a little brown kid who I incidentally had to ride the short bus to school because I had a profound stutter. And they treated me like I was mentally retarded or diminished. So I had a lot of adverse childhood experiences growing up. Growing up in Shasta County and being surrounded by mostly racism and bigotry was difficult. What made it most difficult was there were other white people who were good. And and so I had to sort this out. My prefrontal cortex hadn't evolved. And so a lot of the frustrations I experienced early on going into my teen years, you know, add hormones to being angry for, you know, people being hateful to me was difficult to sort out. So I got involved in you know, petty mischief. And one time I was arrested for allegedly breaking into a house, and I had to go to juvenile hall. While in juvenile hall, I was in solitary confinement for a week. Difficult for children who grow up with adverse effects and experiences to be what we expect is normality, to be productive citizens. Mm-hmm. I got more involved with crime. I got more involved with trying to self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And the good thing is that through getting the heck out of Shasta County, 2 days after I graduated high school, I wanted the heck out of here. I went to the Portland area, and I was able to get involved in the film industry. Mm. And I became a producer director, and I worked a lot over the years, learned from some of the best. And I was able to come back to Shasta County to make a difference. And when I returned in 1995, I went to work as a production manager for a local television station, broadcast television station.
And, you know, so much of what you're talking about is about this issue of racial equity, discrimination, how we talk about race. And you alluded before to some of the changes that you've seen. So I'm wondering what you have experienced and learned through your role in Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition and the task force and other things that you've done about how to bring up and talk about issues of race in a place like Shasta County, and what you've seen has changed. And we'll get back to what's the next steps.
But, oh, okay, sure.
But that part first.
Sure. I have the perspective of time, in as much that I was born here in Shasta County in 1955, little missy. And I've been here a long time, and being a brown person, you know, I've first-handedly, you know, witnessed a lot of hate and just meanness. It's kept me from, you know, being involved in a lot of activities. You know, I was chosen last on team sports. I had a high school gym teacher who would let me practice football with the team, Shasta High, but he wouldn't let me play. And the reason he wouldn't let me play was because he said this: I'll be goddamned if I'm going to have some long-haired brown kid running down my field with his hair bouncing out of his helmet. I have long hair. It's my native tradition. I'm not a hippie. But, you know,
not that there's anything wrong with hippies.
No, nothing wrong. I love them. Many of them I love deeply. But I, you know, I've seen this element of hate last a very long time in my life experience. You know, after, you know, coming back as a tried and true professional and now as an advocate, you know, I started seeing change. I started seeing people empowered by local groups who were speaking out. It gave a voice to things that some people didn't feel they had, but they could belong to something that was significant in helping foster change and development and growth, bringing everybody together. That was hopeful. Recently, I've seen another change to the negative, and I have to really, you know, say this, and this is just my editorial again. I don't mean to upset anybody of extreme conservative Republican sort of ideologies, but when the previous, I don't want to call him a president, but the previous administrator of our country won the election, and over the last several years, he empowered other people and gave voice to people who hated and gave them license to hate. So I've seen a worsening throughout the nation, but definitely in Shasta County. I think it's gone backwards. I think it's worsened probably to the time when I was growing up, but there are more people who are explicitly hateful and damaging to other people of color. You know, one of the recent cases, as you'd mentioned, I serve on the Hate Crimes Task Force under the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, they've, you know, the case of late that they've worked on related to hate-related crimes is the Sherry Papini case. Mm-hmm. Do I have time to talk about that?
A little bit.
Yeah, okay. Basically, you know, your listeners probably recall that, you know, she came up with a very elaborate, complicated hoax that she was kidnapped by mean Hispanic women who had guns, and they tortured her, and they listened to terrible mariachi music and made her listen to it, and gave these awful descriptions of what they looked like in police sketches. Well, long and the short of it is, after 5 years of her frightening the Hispanic Latino community, in particular Latinas, who went into hiding because they were fearful of being arrested for something they had nothing to do with, because they might look like the people in those sketches. You know, they created ways to cope with that in fear and wanted to hide. They didn't want to ride in vans or in SUVs. They would only go out in public if they had a witness with them. So they did these coping mechanisms to try and deal with this hateful thing. So thanks to the brilliant work of, Philip Talbert with the DOJ U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, and their forensics division, they're able to disprove this woman as being criminal and harming and victimizing a whole community of Latinos. You know, her trial convicted her. She'll be in for sentencing in just a couple of weeks, July 11th. And that will be the sentencing component to that. And thanks to brilliant law enforcement professionals who saw that through, you know, we're seeing some change in there. So things can better when people mm-hmm. get better mm-hmm. and are active. Fortunately, law enforcement got very active in that. And so I have hope. I have hope. I think things will better here as we go along.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I wanted to end there with what is giving you hope and how can people become involved in creating more equity, fair and equal justice in our community?
Wow. I have to say it. Awareness is one thing. Knowing that the problems exist is important. I think it's important for everybody, young and old, to carefully select their news sources. Be diverse in your news sources. Listen, you know, to, I mean, I strongly advocate for independent local news sources. We have Shasta Scout locally, which is absolutely yes. brilliant, and one of my favorite news sources, next to a news cafe, Donnie Chamberlain's wonderful outreach. It's very balanced, neutral reporting that is unafraid to tell the truth that most local news organizations are afraid to do. Why? They don't want to insult their advertisers. Mm-hmm. So independent news sources are really fundamental, I think, in and a pillar of democracy. And I'm not blowing that up too much. So I think it's important for just us regular people, you know, and your listeners right now to be aware of what's going on and get active. If you don't have the time because, you know, the warp and woof of living is so difficult sometimes and gas prices are so high so you can't, you know, drive to do things you want to do, dig into your pockets. Contribute and try and do it on a sustainable level. If you can't afford, you know, $50 a month continually as a subscriber, as a member, do $10, but be consistent, because the planning that, you know, well-meaning organizations have to do is involved in that sustainability component, which is regular contributions. Mm-hmm. It really does help. And just feel good that you're doing something. I think there are many people that are part of the problem and problems that surround us. There are some of us who want to be part of the solution. Mm-hmm. Most of us are just part of the landscape. and are waiting for somebody else to do something. Please don't be that person. Do something, even if it's giving 10, 25 bucks a month to KKRN, great organizations, Justice Equity, you know, the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition, as they're reforming now and trying to reorganize, and they have my total support, of course. And speak out, write a letter to the editor, you know, be involved as best you can, show up to the rallies, be a body at some of the protests, be a body at some of the rallies of successes, celebrate the successes. That's my best advice, I think, as a long-term activist. We're better.
Well, thank you so much,
Alan.
It's been so good to have you on the show. Gracias. If you're just tuning in, you can find us archived on kkrn.org, Bending the Arc Show. And just to say that the views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of the radio show or Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of the station. So we look forward to hearing you, seeing you on our next show, and check us out online.